Thanks for listening to the Drummer's Weekly Groovecast. You can contact the show at twitter.com/DW Groovecast and through Facebook at facebook.com/Drummer's Weekly Groovecast.
Good evening.
I am warning you right now, if you touch my drums, I will stab you in the neck with a knife.
Ain't a fucking. Ain't a fucking.
Mom!
Take it easy. Lower it.
I'm not going to lower it. I have to do this now.
I don't mind you playing it, but lower it.
Well, we get straight out?
No, we had a problem. I mean, we tried to do everything we could.
What do you mean?
Well, you know what I mean.
Nice! Little trouble there. You're rushing.
Yeah, well, you know, that's just like your opinion, man.
Yeah!
John, you ever notice that I always wait until Philly does at least 1-4 before we start this show?
That's because we are all about respect for our fellow drummers, especially gods like him.
Not according to some of the email we get.
Anyway.
You knew that somebody was going to say, why are you talking over Philly, man?
Well, we probably, I mean, I can say if I were talking over Philly, I'd just be to keep from hearing how good he is and getting depressed.
Well, we're going to have a little bit of throwback talk toward Philly at the end of the show. Hint, hint, tease, tease. We're going to do a little segment at the end on one of our underappreciated drummers. It's not Philly, but it's kind of a throwback to Philly. You
know? Yes, sir.
Yeah.
Definitely influenced.
Well, thanks, everybody, for listening to the show. We want to throw out big thanks to everyone, especially, again, over the guys at Drum Forum. You guys have given us encouragement to go on. And let me tell you, I need it after my drive over here to see you today, John.
Atlanta.
And a couple close calls on the way over. We're just happy to be. It's going to be a cheerful show today because we're just happy to be alive.
And that's the truth.
Yeah. Well, speaking of our listeners, thanks again, guys, for tuning in, and we appreciate all your comments. We're getting all kinds of good stuff, of which we're actually going to address a little bit of listener questions and email on the show today, which again we appreciate. You guys can contact us through the normal channels. Our email account is drummersweeklygroovecast@gmail.com. you can also check us out at Facebook on our Facebook page at facebook.com/drummersweeklygroovecast, and on Twitter, which is, again, it's starting to pile up. We're getting followers, John. It's at @DWGroovecast. And then, but on the frowny face side of things, I'm going to use some emoticons on this show.
Okay.
We need to get more people over to our YouTube page.
Yeah, I was thinking about that earlier, and I haven't partaken in that yet, and I need to, so I'm going to jump on there and post some stuff, and maybe you can follow suit and everyone come and join us. We'll try to make the content exciting and make it worth your while.
Yeah. And then, you know, what we'll also do is, as naturally the show is being posted on YouTube, but we're also going to put content on there, whether it be videos, regarding some of the different music that we discuss on the show. We're going to post that on there, but we're also going to put some exclusive content on there as well. We'll try to alert you about that stuff through our Twitter page and Facebook timeline and feed as well. So we'll try to keep everybody up to date, you know, so you'll know that, hey, some new stuff's posted on there. Go check it out.
I like it.
Yeah. So anyway, guys, today's topic, we promised a long time ago that we were going to appeal to what we call the pure drummer, the gearhead, the knob twister, the tweaker. Today's the day. Yeah. We're going to talk about swivel nuts and all kinds of good stuff on today's show. So, yeah, we're going to talk about tuning today. We had somebody allude to that. I can't remember how it came to us, John. It was either on the Facebook page or an email. Somebody said something about what are your thoughts on tuning? How do you approach it and whatnot? And one thing that's definitely different about that on our instrument as opposed to, say, guitar or piano is that we don't have a standard tuning.
Right.
It's very subjective.
Certainly far from an exact science, and the ever popular subject of opinions factors into in that we all kind of have our preference as far as tuning and approach and what's right or wrong. And I think that right or wrong is really kind of just a little off base in that what are you going for, or what is your engineer going for, or, you know, that should really be the focus. And, you know, someone might not take the same approach as you do, but the end result is by all means the most important thing. And I think that if you have been doing it long enough, you know, and through trial and error, that there are a number of different approaches. And you know, I just encourage anyone who's maybe new to tuning or just stuck in a rut, which I have certainly come up against in my years of doing this, that, you know, ask some other people, check it out, you know, listen to some different people's opinions on it and approaches on it, and some cool things could come of that.
Well, and the way we're going to address it, John, is very much in that matter. In other words, we're going to talk about this kind of from the ground up. And there's going to be a lot of leeway for interpretation mm-hmm. on some of these things, but we're going to address it from the get-go as far as, like, if you're starting from scratch. And what I mean by that is we're going to assume that the heads are off the drums. We're going to go through getting the drum prepared all the way up to head choices, putting them on, and tuning them up for a variety of different styles. For a variety of different styles of drums themselves, including sizes and, you know, just the characteristics of even some drums like to be tuned different ways. And, you know, we'll kind of address that a little bit as well. Mm-hmm. But to your point, again, this is a very subjective thing, and we're just going to give you kind of our take on how we approach these different things. So you can, you know, use it for what you like or jettison it if need be.
Yes, and don't be distracted by, you know, Phil maybe having a little more excitement about this subject than I do in our delivery. I will be honest with you, I'm not the most passionate individual when it comes to tuning, and we could get into why, but I'm not going to do that.
And ironically, his kits sound like $1 million.
Ugh, occasionally.
So anyway, we're going to start this thing from the ground up. And John, what I thought we would start with is just, let's talk about what it looks like when we're getting ready to put some new drum heads on. And basically, I wrote down, we got to have a few tools, got to have a few things close by mm-hmm. to get started. And the list that I have, or what I should say, what I have near me when I'm getting ready to do this, is, of course, you got to have some drum keys nearby. Some folks like to use the speed key. There's a bunch of different varieties of those that you can use. And those are especially really good for getting drum heads off.
Right.
And then some guys, I know you in particular, John, especially when you're doing a bunch of drums, you like to, I think you use a drill with a key bit.
I sure do.
Right? Yep. And then I also like to have some sort of tension rod lubricant. Some people like Vaseline. That works great. Some people like the white lithium grease. The one thing I will tell you on this, don't make the old rookie mistake. Don't get black grease.
Mm-mm.
You're going to be in for a world of hurt.
That's nasty business.
Yeah, that's not good stuff. I also like to have for cleanup a few paper towels or cloth laying around there. You're going to need that. You're going to need it to rub down your bearing edges if you have any stuff stuck to them. And, of course, just to get the requisite lithium grease / Vaseline off your hands. If I'm working on an older drum, especially if I've got something where the bearing edge is a little bit rough, I'll even have a little, I've got a little round tube of beeswax. Mm-hmm. You can put that on the bearing edge if you need it. Don't really need it for newer drums, in my opinion. Although some of the hardcore old school guys will say you got to do it regardless. Got to do it, right?
You got to.
And, of course, you got to have some drumsticks. You got to tap around on those drums.
Certainly helps. Yeah.
And then if you're going to do any muffling, whether it be like for a bass drum or for tom-toms or snare drum, you can use the muffling of your choice, whether it be like little pieces of moon gel. Some folks will use pieces of old drum head. Mm-hmm. That works pretty good.
Gaff tape is a tried and true old deal with like the Jeff Beccaro folded gaff tape routine.
I don't know that we should ever do a podcast without mentioning gaff tape as the, that's the MVP of virtually every gig in one way or another, isn't it?
I'm a true believer in it for a million reasons.
The gaff tape company's a true believer in it anyway. Go buy a large roll. It'll run you like $50 these days, you know?
Yeah, they definitely hammer you.
Yeah, and then lastly, you got to have some drum heads. And boy, there's a whole variety of those you can go through, huh?
There is. One thing that I would encourage you to do is, that I've run into problems with is on two-ply heads, I'm an adamant checker of heads when I buy them. As a matter of fact, I rarely buy two-ply heads online because I'm so hardcore about making sure they're what I want. And a lot of that came from, for a long period of time, I did a ton of teching and a ton of rentals, like studio rentals. And two-ply heads were a real pain in my butt because I would go, you know, maybe I'd buy four heads for a four-tom kit or something for a session, and two of them would just be dead, and I just couldn't do anything about them. And I figured out that oftentimes there's air between the plies, and it just will, if you hold the head up and hit it, it's just dead as a cardboard box. So I figured out with two-ply heads, my experience, in my opinion, is the ones that sound really papery when you tap them typically don't have that air lock in there, and they tend to open up and give you tone and give you sustain and all of that. And so that's one thing to not shoot yourself in the foot early on is, you know, more so with two-ply heads, is just make sure that it's a good serviceable head. It's not, you know, you're not fighting it from the word go.
I'm just going to stop this show right here. That's good, man. There's nothing I'm going to say that's going to be any better than that. Oh, I just learned something.
Yeah, that was I've had some expensive lessons regarding that. And normally that real dead sounding head is, that's just in that process, inevitably there's going to be some air that gets between plies. And that's the end result of that mistake. So be a little more selective when it comes to two-ply heads. I know a lot of guys like them on certain kits. I love them. So you're not battling that. That's something to think about.
Well, that is sage advice right there that I'm taking to heart. So right. Let's go ahead and jump into some individual drums.
Oh, you know what? Before, okay, I forgot in tools.
Oh, yeah.
I'm a hard core user of something that some people just hate, and that's the drum dial. And it kind of was born more out of one situation was I was living somewhere where I couldn't make a lot of noise for a while. And so I'd want to get things in the ballpark before I'd get to a sound check so I could just tweak. And mind you, I don't think that a drum dial is a be-all and end-all. I think it gets you in the ballpark, especially when you're talking about multiple heads on a kit, you know, in one sitting. It gets things kind of in the ballpark and all that. So I like to use that. Some people talk about that TuneBot, which I'm not familiar with. But I used to tech some kits at a big church where there was multi-campuses and multi-stages, and I think it was 7 kits at one point. And anything I could do, you know, the drill, the drum dial, getting things kind of, you know, where you're not just running blind, and that those are some things that I that have helped me a lot. And you know, some of these old school guys are like, blah blah blah, you wouldn't use that. I'm like, you know what, man, you use a computer to help you find out information. You know, you use tools every day that make your life easier. In my opinion, that makes my life easier. So I encourage you to check out things like that, because it can get you it can save you some time and some frustration.
Wow. Well, there's two things I'm going to have to work on there. Because I mean, because I've always just done it. And like I said, we're putting the cart a little bit in front of the horse here, because we're going to address this a little bit more. But, man, I've always just done it literally by feel, you know, that sort of thing. I can really feel it, you know, as far as like when I'm getting to where I need to be. But that sounds like that eliminates a little bit of that guesswork.
Like I said, it's not the...
Yeah,
you know, it's not just the magic solution, but it oftentimes gets things. Now, granted, your drums got to be pretty together with that. Like, you can't have an out of round or slightly a bearing edge slightly off on it, because your readings are going to be funny. But I'd like to think my drums are all in pretty stellar shape, and if they haven't, I have a couple techs that'll go over that and make sure that they are. So I'm starting with a, you know, a tool or a drum that is going to allow that tool to be effective. And I know in your case, just about everything you own, that's not going to be an issue either, because it's, you know, stunningly good drums and high quality drums are allow you to use that tool effectively. So
duly noted. So now that we've kind of covered the things that you're going to need, all right, let's go ahead and jump into some actual tuning processes and preferences. Okay. And we're going to start from the ground up. We'll start with bass drum. And a couple of things that you know that the listener is going to need to know right off the bat is, well, what kind of heads are you using, especially for the resonant side? Because the two obvious choices is you're going to have one that's either going to be ported. And what we mean by that is one that's going to have a hole in it that allows for miking. And the other way is a non-ported head. And so basically, my dividing line on that is, if I'm playing my rock and pop gigs that need to be mic'd, I absolutely use a ported head. It doesn't necessarily affect the resonance so much, simply from the standpoint that I'm muffling that drum fairly significantly anyway.
That's not something that oftentimes is overlooked in that
absolute
argument.
Yeah. As opposed to when I'm playing a straight ahead thing and I'm using an 18-inch bass drum, it's always got a full resonant head on the front, and the majority of the muffling that's done there is one of two ways, is either through a felt strip, which I will use from time to time. And sometimes another thing I actually kind of like even better than that is I will use a small towel, roll it up, and a lot of times put it not against the resonant head, but actually put it against the batter head.
You put it like between the pedal frame and the head?
Yeah, it works great. Yeah, and then the thing is also, not to get too far off subject here, but a lot of times if I'm either in a session or live and somebody wants to mic the bass drum in for like the little 18-inch open bass drum, I actually have them mic it on the batter side.
Oh, that's interesting.
Yeah, and not the resonant side. You know, so I have them do that. So now, the tuning aspect of it, because that's what we're talking about here. For that resonant side, my take on the ported head is this. I normally have that head tuned low, not much past the wrinkle stage on there, to get just a nice low fundamental on that. And for the actual full drum head resonant side, like if I'm going to play the 18-inch bass drum that's wide open, I use a little bit more of a tom-tom approach from that standpoint, and will tune that resonant head sometimes a little higher than the batter head on that. And it gives me a couple things. Naturally, it will allow a little more resonance and will also give you somewhat of a tad bit of a pitch bend on that, which can be a nice thing for that sort of kit and for that sort of setup. So that's kind of my approach to the resonant side. For the batter side on both of those, for the larger bass drum that is muffled for the rock and pop type thing, I kind of like, I'm a big fan of the power stroke style, single ply power stroke style drum head. And again, tuned pretty loosely, man. I mean, loosely enough from the standpoint that it seems like a lot of times, especially if my drums are traveling somewhere, if they're on a truck, it seems like always a tension rod or two will jingle jangle a bit.
Yeah,
you know, they get loosened up.
Yep.
And definitely. So it's again, not much past a wrinkle. And again, you have to keep in mind that when we're talking about this, guys, this is a muffled bass drum. We're talking about primarily getting, you do get resonance, but you're primarily getting attack. Mm-hmm. You're getting impact sound for this.
Yeah. That's something that gets lost, I think, sometimes in conversation. Like, I've noticed on forums a lot of times that the guys that are saying, I never port and I never muffle, you know, if you look a little deeper into it, they're not gigging a lot. And if they are, they're not, you know, they don't have a cranky sound man who knows what he's doing, miking up their kit. And all.
Good
so,
point.
You know, as a working player, I think we by default end up, especially with the bigger drum and the more the, you know, groove sound and muffled sound, all that, you just make things a lot easier for everybody, including yourself, to go ported, have the pillow of your liking in there or whatever it is, and make things, you know, a lot easier. Now, interesting enough, on the tuning side of things with a bass drum, I completely go by feel on that.
Uh-huh.
I never...
No drum dial.
No, none of that.
Okay.
It's always just past the point of wrinkle and then just kind of feel and hear and how it just feels in my gut, you know, when I'm playing it.
Yeah.
That it just kind of falls into place as you tweak a little here and there. Front, I'm a little more insecure about the front head tuning, but it normally just kind of finds its place. Totally a feel thing versus more the scientific slash tool approach that I might do with tom or snare. So
yeah,
and go figure.
You know, another thing, I don't know how you feel about these, John, but I can appreciate the retro and vintage kind of thing of using the T-rod style tension rods, but I actually prefer just the regular drum key kind of tension rods.
Always.
Yeah.
Even on my vintage kits, a lot of times.
You replace them.
Yeah, because I just, and you know, to be honest with you, I probably replace T-rods more because they become a pain in the butt when you're trying to put it in your bag.
Well,
I'm just annoyed by that at the end of the night. So
I've got a couple of Gretsch kits that are vintage that have the T rods and just quite honestly, they sometimes get bent.
Yeah, that's really common with those
too. Yeah, you know, so that's a drag. You know, when you have that happen as well,
no doubt.
Looks a little bit weird.
I probably have 25 bent Gretsch T rods sitting in some box in my garage. You know, they just. I don't know what it is about those in particular, but they tend to want to bend easy.
I smell an eBay auction.
Oh, man. I'm okay with that. Buy my junk.
Yeah. And then quickly about the batter head for the small drum. My approach to that is, again, a single ply head. I can go either way, like I earlier mentioned, about felt strip on there and or... a towel, you know, up against the batter head. One thing I think that sometimes gets lost a little bit with the felt strip, I think a lot of people don't really know how to install that very much anymore. The biggest thing I can tell everybody when you're putting a felt strip on is when you lay that thing across your bearing edge, depend, you can lay it vertically or horizontally, depending on, you know, how you feel about it, is once you then put the drum head on there and then you put the, you start putting the tension rods and the hoop back on there and tightening it up, what you have to do to make that thing effective is you then have to pull that felt strip to where it lines up flush against the head, or it doesn't work. I've seen some drum sets before that guys will put it on and it's real loose, and it's not touching it up against the head. So you do have to pull that thing to get it to seat up against your batter head when you do that. So just keep that in mind if you want to experiment with that. Now, one thing, John, have you ever seen this before? There's I think it's Aquarian that makes this drum head that has a felt strip already attached.
It's on
to
it. I love that.
Works good, man.
Yep. I also have, I figured out, back to the glorious subject of gaff tape, I will take that felt strip and put it on and heavily gaff tape it on the shell, because gaff tape doesn't, you know, it's not like duct tape where it's leaving residue and all that.
Right.
But I'll put the felt strip on, tape one side of the shell, pull it taut, tape the other side, put the head on, and it typically is flush too. If, you know, like sometimes like the pull thing is like, I don't know, this mine's just a lazy man's approach to getting that taut ultimately. But another option you can do if you're not, you know, comfortable pulling it, or if it keeps pulling out or whatever, you can always tape it on each end, but just make sure it's really taut.
Right. And then after I get all that stuff together, then tune it up, I will actually get, I'll get that bass drum, for my preference, I'll get that batter head tuned up fairly tight. Again, trying to get, from that standpoint, a little bit more of a tom-tom sort of vibe. Because even if I'm feathering the bass drum on that, there will of course be resonance, but there will be enough attack, so to speak, on that feathering quarter note bass drum pattern that I'm playing that will, it will certainly give enough bottom end, low end to the band and reinforce the bass line enough. And it'll be a good mix of some resonance and, of course, natural attack for the bass drum beater.
Yeah, I always kind of view, in that traditional bebop tuning vibe, I don't really think of the bass drum as a bass drum like I would if I'm like the you know, the foundation of a kit and that fat groove. It's just like a fourth voice, you know?
Yeah.
That's all. It's like it's like a lower tom you're playing with your foot. But that's kind of how I've always thought of it when I'm tuning for that, in that, I know a couple guys that will use an 18-inch bass drum on like a hybrid groove kind of gig where they're doing maybe some jazz stuff early and they'll use like a EMAT or something like that. Oh, it's amazing. It's got low end. And all. Well, if you're approaching it that way, sure. But in more the traditional acoustic jazz sense, I think get out of it, maybe get out of the mindset of it being a bass drum as we think of a bass drum, and tune. It's just another voice, and get tone and get, you know, think along those lines. And cool, that's an interesting and cool way to come about.
Yeah,
that vibe you're talking about.
Right. And I'll tell you, my mindset is, I still do approach, even when I'm playing that style of music, I still approach it, so to speak, from the ground up. You know, in other words, I will use it from the standpoint of a bass drum, to where it does reinforce the low end. But yeah, I do absolutely also have the mindset of like, this is an active voice on the drum set that is more than just, we'll call it timekeeping. It's an active voice that improvises inside of the timekeeping.
Right.
And therefore, having that little bit of tone and that voice and that sound along with the impact sound, it integrates within the rest of the toms, cymbals, and snare drum as an active improvising timekeeper.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Anything else you want to add on bass drum there, John, before we move on?
No, I think that covers it pretty well.
Well, let's go ahead and move on to toms now, because we've alluded a little bit about that before.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, one thing in particular that I want to cover, and I want you to definitely, because you've got a great handle on this, is let's talk about the different hoops that are available by different manufacturers mm-hmm. that go on tom-toms. And primarily what I'm talking about is triple flange tubes, which you find readily on virtually every manufacturer will use triple flange hoops from time to time, versus there are a couple companies that use die cast hoops. Mm-hmm. And then just to kind of describe for folks that are not familiar with those, die cast hoops are the heavier all cast one piece of metal hoops that are, like I said, they're heavier. They have a tendency to dry the drum out a little bit. Primarily use the one I always like to talk about is Gretsch. Mm-hmm. They always use die cast hoops top and bottom, as opposed to triple flanged hoops, which are, I think some people call them spun hoops. They're lighter. They tend to open up a drum a little bit more. But John, tell us how you feel about both of those and kind of the properties how they sound to you and how you approach.
Well, certainly on toms, you have in the triple flange hoops, they, you know, more open sound for sure. And I think depending on the shell makeup, it can dictate what heads you're using more so. My experience is like on a Gretsch kit, you could use any head on a Gretsch tom. It's going to sound different, obviously,
right?
But it's going to work though, because the die cast tube is kind of the great equalizer.
Rigid, yeah.
Yeah, and just sort of, you know, so it's just, you know, the property of the head design and material is going to dictate more of that. But a triple flange hoop, you know, you have a lot more openness. So you're talking about, you know, certain, like an all maple drum with a triple flange hoop. You're getting that's a live drum, man, you know. Mm-hmm. So in that lower tuning, you know, sometimes a single flange or single ply head, it might just be a little overbearing. It might be just too much going on, too much overtones, all that. You know, maybe you go with a two ply and all that. Definitely more open, definitely more room for overtones, room for just a lot more sonically happening. Mm-hmm. Versus the die-cast being a little more focused and drier. And it's not right or wrong, it's all that, but from my experience, I think you have to be a little more mindful of head choices. Like I know, mm-hmm. you know, if you have a vintage Ludwig three-ply drum, you know, chances are a pinstripe's just not really going to be a great choice to bring about all that is beautiful about that drum. And this is just my opinion, but you know, it just kind of begs for maybe a single ply coated head, and it's just the nature of the way the shell's made, the reinforcement hoops, triple flange hoops, all of that. Again, you know, it's just dictating a little more what head it wants. And then, like I said, you can get into more like the Gretsch thing, and I mean, it's wide open. I mean, I've tried every head on a Gretsch drum, and they all work. They all mm-hmm. work, you know, whether you like it or not.
Yeah.
One particular head versus another is another story, but it's amazing how triple flange can be a little more finicky in that sense.
You know, and one thing I think is kind of interesting regarding die cast hoops is that I've had it happen before where I've had a drum tuned up and you play a gig and you don't even notice it till the end of the gig. One of the tension rods is nearly backed completely yeah. out, and the rigidity of that die cast hoop will hold that drum in tune really well.
So true.
You know,
that's kind of along the same line. We've laughed about some people poo poo on Gretsch's 5-lug 10 and 12 inch hoops, and it's sort of just like it almost doesn't matter because of mm-hmm. what you just said. Like the uniform tension in the circumference of the drum stays relatively close as long as the other four tension rods are engaged and at the tension. So it's kind of like a, you know, oh yeah, it doesn't really affect tuning a whole lot. You know, it's just, you're still ultimately taking 5 points on the head and trying to get it in tune with itself versus six. So that argument always was kind of like, maybe you have an agenda against Gretsch versus you have an agenda against Five Lug Hoops.
Right.
You know, what's the truth here? Because die-cast hoops are far more forgiving in that sense.
So with that in mind, John, when you are prepping for a pop rock gig, what's your basic tuning tenets for toms?
I normally will go... I kind of have come back to clear heads in that setting. Mm-hmm. I just, you know, I mean, I'm a product of the 80s in a lot of ways, and that sound and that feel. And I just, they just tend to work a lot. But I'll normally go with a clear single ply on the bottom, clear two ply on the top. You know, coated two ply is cool too. But generally, I try to get it tuned down about as low as I can get it to go without it just completely flattening out and, you know, losing all of that or creating weird overtones by way of it.
What is your relationship bottom head tightness to top?
Man, I'm kind of a pretty even tension guy.
Yeah.
Like the pitch bend thing, I kind of feel like that's more dumb luck than it is an exact science. And I get the theory behind it, but I just don't have the patience to mess with it. So I kind of just sort of am like, oh, just let me get it in tune with itself.
Right.
And then, you know, then do some muffling. So that's kind of my thing. And I know there's guys that really like that pitch bend thing and have got it pretty locked in. I just personally tend to be like, man, I want to get it in tune with itself, have it fat and resonant and not running from itself.
You know, one thing that I like to think in a little bit of a concept in my tuning with toms like that is that I do like a very slight pitch bend, not one of the severe style pitch bends where you have the boom, not one of those.
Right.
But I think that by the nature of using a single ply head or a thinner head for the resonant side, and then a thicker head, even if, for example, if you've got a clear single ply head for resonant, and if you've even got a single coated head for the batter, even though they're both single ply heads, the top head, by the nature of the coating, is going to be a little thicker and a tad bit darker. That even if you do have both of those heads tuned relatively close, that bottom head is still going to be just a tad bit higher pitch simply from the standpoint of it being a thinner head, right?
Agreed. So that's true.
So kind of my approach to it is I get the heads fairly close with indeed the bottom head a slightly bit tighter with a little bit of higher pitch. And I always like to think, especially with my tom-toms, I think in terms of I tune the bottom head first, especially for like a pleasing pitch, right? I try to, if I'm tapping around on the drum, try not to hear any like strident overtones or strident pitches that come immediately out, you know? Something that's got a pleasant tone. And then I will tune the top head primarily that it feels good. And of course that it's tensioned properly, right? So I do the old trick of, and I know most drum heads are made significantly better than they were 25 or 30 years ago. But even as I put the drum heads on, I do put my thumb or hand down in the middle of it, try to stretch them out a little bit as they go on, right? And then as I tune it up, again, get it tuned to where it feels good. And then naturally the top head will affect the pitch as well. Not quite as much as the bottom head. But then I will then fine tune that top head to get it to a proper pitch and to where it works in sympathy with the bottom head. And I will use, as far as that, the head combination, bottom head is virtually always single ply clear. Top head, I will go between clear, double ply, and then sometimes traditional single ply coated heads. And here's the thing, John, the majority of the time when I'm tuning for like pop or rock, the concept and the way that I tune it will be identical. In other words, whether it's a double ply or a single ply, it's just that I know the single ply will give me overall slightly higher pitch overall and a little bit more resonance you know, and not using any muffling, so to speak.
Right.
You know. And then whenever I'm doing like a straight ahead thing, like if I want to tune them up high, like we're going back to like the little bebop kit, I tune them up high, man. I mean, I get them up there.
Make them scream.
Yeah, yeah. Where, and the primary reason for that is you know as well as I do that if you're going to end up playing brushes, if any of your drums are tuned down really low, they're not even going to speak.
No.
Whenever you're going to get no articulation and no resonance at all. So, and again, we're talking in generalities here. So in other words, me tuning them up high to somebody may not be high enough, you know, so to speak. So, you know, we're talking in generalities here. Bottom head, once again, clear, single ply, tuned up high. I heard somebody on a forum say, it's tight enough to where it's screaming for its lawyer.
Yeah.
So, I've heard that before. And then top head for the straight ahead stuff will always be single ply coated. Again, for brushes, mm-hmm. if you need to on that. And again, tuned up high, not as high as the bottom head again, but they'll be tuned up high enough to where there's not a pitch bend.
Right.
Then in that case. And you could even say that for the larger drums that I do that with on the bebop stuff also, is that they're tuned up significantly higher than one would expect on a pop or rock kind of a gig. And again, they're tuned up high enough, like say a 14-inch floor tom, where I'm using, again, clear single ply on the bottom, coated single ply on top, to where you hit it, there's not going to be enough resonance to get a pitch bend, a pure pitch bend, so to speak.
Yeah. Well, the whole idea of that, you know, it's funny, like, when I think about playing straight ahead, I don't want really resonant toms.
Yeah.
Because you're doing far more
mm-hmm.
intricate and, you know, notier things where all that, you know, it's not a big power ballad here we're talking about.
Right, and it's the kind of thing also that by the nature of what we're playing in that style, if we're playing in a pure acoustic setting with acoustic bass, acoustic piano, horns, that kind of thing, you don't need that much resonance to fulfill or fill out a sound that's being overpowered by electric instruments.
Right.
So the articulation that you get, you know, from those drums it's going to be very important. And again, if it's too boomy, if it's too loud, you're going to lose some of that articulation. And especially so the lighter that you play. Again, it's very difficult to play straight ahead stuff and feel really good about it on really big, deep, open, you know, floppy, like flappy
when drum we do hits. A dinner set at a wedding and you're playing on your big groove kit.
Heresy, John.
It's awful.
Heresy.
Hey, yeah. What? I'll tell you what, man. My next gig, if you want to bring a little bebop kit for my dinner set, I'll play it.
What do I get out of it?
Your buddy not
bucket full
committing
of
heresy to your sacred jazz music. You'll hear my bad brush playing clearly because they speak. I don't know. That's all I got. Hey, real quick on the tom thing. Given time, like if I know, you know, I got a day or two, maybe it's a session or I'm just going to change heads before the weekend.
Mm-hmm.
Anything like that. I will, without a doubt, put new heads on and really crank them up and let them sit.
Oh, yeah.
Let them seat mm-hmm. the heads that way as opposed to this. Like I'll crank them like bebop tuning.
Oh, yeah.
And then then back them down and start from scratch there. So, you know, given the time, I like to do that.
I think the great Simon Phillips does that, too. I love that guy, by the way. Anytime I can work him into a podcast, I'm going to.
You got a man crush on that guy.
I do. I like that guy, man. He's good.
It's his big bass drums, no doubt.
I thought it was his curly locks.
That could be. Yeah. Or that he's short and you think I could take him.
I know I could take him.
I met him at a NAMM show way back, like, it was a summer show in Chicago. That's how long ago this was. So think about it. Like, we took a wagon train to the convention.
I was going
to
say, that was so far back, man. I'll have to calculate that on an abacus, right?
Maybe. But he, I had no idea. and he walks up and he's like 4'8".
Yeah.
And I was just, I think the look on my face was probably pretty telling and embarrassing. But
he plays a whole pile of drums, though, man.
Big ones too.
Yeah,
it's so bizarre. But he's a little guy, man, and sounds like he's larger than life. So
he is, man.
It's pretty awesome stuff.
You know, one last thing before we move on to snare drums. Something I was just thinking about. Also, I might be the only guy that does this, but I always when I'm replacing heads, and it doesn't matter if I'm tuning for 5 toms or if I'm tuning for 2, I always start tuning with the largest toms first and go back up.
That tends to work well for me too.
Yeah, it's just, I think most everybody that after you've done it for a little while kind of realizes that getting the larger drums in tune it's a little bit of a challenge. You got to find their happy place first, and then you can most of the time make those smaller drums fit where you need them to.
You're absolutely right.
Yeah. Let's talk about snare drums now.
Oh, the ever popular.
You know, I don't have nearly as strong opinions on this as a lot of people do. I'm the snare drum equivalent of your bass drum.
Yeah.
Tuning. And maybe it's just because I don't know what I'm doing.
I don't know, man. I've never heard a snare drum of yours that doesn't sound like you don't know what you're doing.
Well, I appreciate the confidence.
My approach on snare drums is, again, I really crank out the heads first, back them down, start. I have some settings on a drum dial for my bottom heads on my main snare drums I use that really have brought me to a really consistent place, and I don't stress on it at all.
Yeah.
And that's, again, why I love that tool, because snare drums, in that bottom head especially, man, you've got to get it right.
What do you use, like, style of bottom head?
I have kind of gravitated to the really super thin. If I can find the Ludwig ones, I like those.
Mm-hmm.
Evans, their 300 is clear and thin like that. The Remo ones I like. I'm a Remo guy in general. But for some reason, those thinner, clear heads that Evans and Ludwig have seem to bring about something I'm hearing. Some sensitivity maybe or something.
Mm-hmm.
And I know the collar thing factors in too.
Yeah.
You know, the Remo one will tend to pull out and give and stretch a little easier than the other. So that might be part of, like, it lasts a little longer for me or stays consistently where I want it in the Ludwig head and in the... so that I've kind of gone that route now. I used to be just a hardcore Remo guy. I'm a little more lenient on certain bass drum, batter, and snare resonant heads now. So I don't know. You're supposed to be old and set in your ways, and I'm kind of going the opposite route. It's weird.
Could that be senility?
It could be. It could be, quite frankly, that maybe I got those Evans 300 heads for $2.50 cheaper than the Remo ones. I mean, who are we kidding? You know, sometimes that blow. I had the beauty of drumforum.org. Every once in a while, someone will put up like $5 Evans G1 coated, you know, that kind of thing. So I'll stock up like that. Our dear friend Jeff Riley,
mm-hmm,
threw some music store blowing out their heads the other day, and I got 10 coated ambassadors for, you know, $65 shipped or something stupid like that.
Thanks for letting me know.
I grab, well, you just, you know, I know you and Roy and your little romance. I didn't want to get you in trouble, man.
My Roy-mance.
Your Roy-mance.
Yeah.
Chris Brady, you know, leaving long, heated messages on your phone for cheating on them.
Wow. They're good dudes, man.
Yeah. But I all joking aside, I'm liking this clear, thin thing.
Well, you know, and one thing about the snare drum stuff that we're going to talk about is that more so than any of these other styles of drums, tom-toms and bass drums and whatnot, there are probably more variables on a snare drum than any other drum. And taste. Because, I mean, of course, you've got all the varieties of different shell compositions of the myriad of woods, especially of these boutique manufacturers, but you've also got a myriad of metals also.
That, you know, and man,
snare
we can
beds
get
versus nut, you know what I mean?
That's huge. Snare beds can, I mean, that is something that often is overlooked. And
absolutely.
Oh, I don't like that Bubinga snare drum. Well, it could be that it's got crappy snare beds on it. You know, I tend to like real gradual snare drums. It brings out sensitivity and really lets the drum be what it is.
Yeah.
In a lot of the properties of the shell and, you know, even down to the hoop selection on that. That snare bed can be a huge influence on all of that. So, that's something that you should be mindful of and try to figure out what you like.
What top head do you like?
I only use two drum heads. I use either a coated Ambassador or a coated CS.
Okay.
And the coated CS is more underneath, on the
dot underneath.
Yeah, the dot underneath. Mm-hmm. And I use that on most of my backbeat stuff. I like that head. Mm-hmm. It just gives it lowers the pitch slightly. It doesn't really give it a focus. Like sometimes they used to kind of market it like focus. I don't think it gives it a focus as much as it's kind of like a zero ring, the same kind of effect in my opinion. I really like that head a lot, especially on my deeper metal snare drums. Black Beauty, I got a deep Acrolite. I use a 5x14 Superphonic a lot on my steady Saturday night gig, and I tend to use that head on it. But like Acrolites, like higher tuning, I like a Coated Ambassador. Any of my drums that I use for more of a straight ahead or acoustic setting pretty much go that route.
For my stuff, you and I are almost the same except for the resonant side. The resonant side on every single drum, I just use a snare side single ply clear snare side.
Ambassador.
It's Aquarian. Yeah. It'd be the Aquarian classic clear snare side. I have used also, they've got a high frequency snare side as well, which is what would be the Diplomat version.
Okay.
I've used that before as well.
Yeah, I'm just nervous about those in general.
I understand that. Especially,
I mean,
when
if I were just playing low volume maybe, but I still want to believe that I could blow one of those out, which I probably can't.
You absolutely can. I have faith in you.
All right.
Make everybody on this podcast, all the listeners, proud of you.
How macho he is. He blew out a Diplomat.
You know, for virtually every style, though, that I play, except for one notable style of tuning that I'll talk about in a second, again, that resonant side, I mean, it's on the point of becoming a brick wall.
Yeah.
I mean, of being super, super tight, highly tuned. For the resonant side, I'm like you. A lot of times I will use the reverse dot on a coated head. I always use coated heads. Always, 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 always.
Yeah, me
always,
too.
Always, always. And
I don't like how they look otherwise.
You don't like seeing the snares straight through?
No.
Yeah.
I'm a geek in that, like, on my vintage kits, I have to have coated resonant heads just because that's
really
how they came. Yeah. You know, I don't want to.
Yeah.
I don't want people peeping into my vintage drums. Maybe they're too sacred to me or something.
Maybe I don't want them seeing the painted insides of the Ludwig
drums.
It's
just the look.
Yeah.
And it does. It bothers, like a clear snare drum head. That's weird to me. I'm like,
yeah.
All of a sudden, I feel like I'm gonna be asked to play like some rudimental cadence or something. which we both know would be probably the end of my career.
So the top heads that I would again choose would be the regular like classic not classic clear, excuse me, but the texture coated or the single ply coated heads or the reverse dot single ply coated heads. Tuning wise, I'm a little bit on the top head, a little bit like John with bass drum. I just try to get them fairly close for the style of music that I'm playing. For most of my rock and pop stuff, man, it's just a very centralized medium tuning.
Yeah.
Not gospel chops high and not Don Henley long run low.
Right.
You know, somewhere in the middle of that.
It's interesting, too. I probably 20 years ago tended to, you know, maybe I tend to have it a little higher. Some of that's what was popular. Some of that was coming from that period. We both came through that piccolo phase, which was everybody had that whole vibe for a while. But I still go back to this medium tuning and snare drum too, man, the feel.
Yeah.
Like, it's just got to feel right. Like, now at this point, if something's really tight, I almost can't play it.
You know what gets on my last freaking nerve, man, about that super, super high tuning is a lot of times in combination with that, guys will take their snares and super, super gank them up really tight. I mean, as tight as you can get. And you know, when you're sitting behind the drum and you play it, it sounds even choked. But if you get even 10 feet in front of it, it sounds just like a little bleep.
It
sounds awful, man. So one thing in particular I would encourage everybody is don't tighten up your snares so tight to where you just end up getting a little chirp off your drum. That I understand that especially some younger drummers, and I was guilty of this as a kid, you know, you're so accustomed to hearing things on a record or on a CD, and you know, you might hear this muted drum or, you know, at least a gated or something, some kind of a drum, and it sounds like there's no snare rattling anywhere when you hit a tom or the sound. You know, that's just not the case. You know, when you're right on top of a snare drum, it's way more obvious that your snares might be rattling when you hit a tom-tom or even when you hit the snare drum itself. But that actually helps fill out your sound. I would just say be really careful about over tensioning your snares themselves, and which leads me to the other way that I was talking about that I will tune, especially for a rock or pop thing. If I want to go for, we'll say, that Don Henley, the long run sound, that is a case where I will not tune the resonant head super tight. It'll still be tight, but it won't be crazy tight. I have somewhat of an affinity for those 40 strand snares.
Okay.
I'll put on a drum like that, especially a 6.5 Black Beauty style drum. Put a 40 strand snare on there, leave those suckers hanging, man. I mean, hanging down there on the bottom. And then tune the snare drum, batter head, down low, coated, reverse dot, and then mute the crap out of it.
Yep.
And then if it's a recording, then plate reverb all the way, man, to give it some resonance.
You know, there's some things about, especially low tuning, that are overlooked. Use the Don Henley, but that era, there was a lot of that low tune thing. But, you know, what we forget is that sound was as much the recording process as it was the tuning, in that you had the snare drum tuned down and loose and all that, but you also, I mean, you're just in the red with levels because you were recording the tape and you could do that. And that's like guitar sounds as well. Like, certain records from the 70s sound the way they do because they're able to saturate levels in recording, because they're going to tape. It's not digital. It's not, you know, so there's certain things that factor into that, you know, if it's driving you crazy, maybe you're recording at home or whatever, and why can't I get that to do it? Well, there's certain things that you might not be aware of, like, and that's one of them. But as far as, I really, the snare drum in particular, I didn't get it together until I started recording a lot more. Like, mm-hmm. I cringed to think about my sound. I think it was always okay, you know, but that real fine-tuned understanding the nature of a drum in context of a kit, in context of mics, in context of a stage full of other instruments, you know, you really get a better handle on that when you're not sitting behind the kit. And recording is what, you know, I'm not a front of house guy and I don't pay much attention. I'm never in front of a band. You know, I go see a band on occasion, but you know, something else is annoying me, so I'm not focused on the snare drum. But recording really brought it, and especially when I started teching and an engineer or a producer's like, man, I'm going for this vibe. You got to figure it out. And I started paying more attention to it, and subtle things like the tension of the snares.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
How it made a break, it can make or break the whole vibe of the drum. You know, play around with that stuff, but be aware, context is so important in tuning.
Man, and you know what? That made me think. I just wrote something down right when you were talking about the context of this and a subtle thing. You know, something else that I do is when I've gotten my drums 90% in tune, when they're on the kit and or when they're all set up as a kit, I always put my cymbals up and then finish the rest of the tuning, because when you've got the full kit with the cymbals present, it does change things.
Mm-hmm.
And so I always make sure, that was one thing I wanted to say, is that I always make sure the cymbals are on the kit when they get the final tuning before the session or the gig.
That's great, man. You know, that kind of touches on samples too, and how sampling has obviously become a fine art, but early on, you know, they were doing things where they're isolating a drum and sampling it, and it always, like, old drum machine samples, and I'm kind of like, yeah. And, you know, the best engineers and the best audio geeks realized, man, when you're hitting that snare drum, you want all those mics from that kit open,
mm-hmm.
that room being heard, the snares, you know, like all that, because that's truly how you're going to be applying it.
Yep.
Like if you're adding yep. a snare sample, well, you're applying it to a kit. Essentially, it's being played, even if it's samples, it's still an entire kit working as one entity. So to not sample that in mind, or again, not tune with that in mind,
right,
really is problematic. And you have to think past that and think in context, what is it? And, you know, and we while we're sitting there tuning a drum, we're so locked into it that we're losing sight of that. And it's easy to do. I'm guilty of it to this day, but it's like, wait, man, you know, sitting next to three toms or five cymbals.
Right.
Is going to change the dynamic of this drum. You know, you have to remember that. And so maybe it's best that once you get things kind of in tune with itself, is to sit down and really make sure it's working as a unit.
Exactly.
It's really hard. It's hard to keep sight of that sometimes when you're, I got to get this drum locked in, you know.
Right.
Well, it might be right, maybe not.
So to kind of finish up our little segment on tuning, John, at the earliest part of the show, gave you an absolute pearl of wisdom regarding double ply heads. Mm-hmm. I'm going to put my pearl of wisdom now.
All right, man.
Let me tell you something that I always carry with me in like my stick bag, or right now it's in my stick bag in like the pocket on the front. I always keep a piece of 220 sandpaper in there, because especially if you're going to play brushes, when you put a brand new coated head on, it's a little bit thick, the coating is.
Misery.
Yeah, and sometimes there's also a few little imperfections. You know, they might have a little bit of coating that kind of stands up and catches a brush,
yep.
catches a strand. and I sand it off a little bit and get it a little thinner and mm-hmm. just a tad bit smoother so it doesn't catch my brushes. It allows them to move freely. How's that for a pearl of wisdom?
Huh? I love that. I'm so glad you said that because I have in, you know, I put a new snare drum head on and not thinking about that and get to a gig and there's like, oh, we're doing an hour of low-key stuff. And I mean, you just have to block out the misery that is a brand new coated head when you're yeah. playing brushes, because whether you're an accomplished brush player or not, it is a hindrance, I think. And you're proving my point in that you mm-hmm. are well versed in brushes, and it annoys you versus me. I'm an average brush player that has a few patterns, but it's just like I don't need to be distracted more.
Man, you get, so it's like, oh. You get stuck in the mud, literally, man.
Yeah, it's
you know?
Crazy.
Yeah, when you do that.
I'm glad to hear that.
So
that's awesome.
Well, anyway, folks, that's our take on tuning. And by no means is it the be-all, end-all, but it does give you some insight on how we approach it, having done it for years and years and years and years. And we talk a little bit about, you know, the different, of course, styles of music that we have to play and how that affects our tunings and also the different kits. So, you know, I know everyone's going to want to, you know, have their own take on it. So chime in, you know, let us know, you know, if you have something, you know, that you want to add to it or whatever. We're listening, that's for sure.
Yeah, man, I'm open to anybody's idea on tuning. Like I said, I'm not terribly excited about tuning ever because it's difficult, man. I know guys that are 60, 70 years old and been doing it forever, and they'll tell you the same thing. Tuning's a bitch.
Yeah.
It is, man. It's an imperfect science on an imperfect instrument. And, you know, it's trial and error, and you get lucky sometimes. But try to find an approach you can, you know, at least get you to a reasonable place and you can start fine-tuning.
If you can't tell by that, we're asking for help.
Help. Come and tune my drum so I don't have to.
There you go. So we mentioned earlier also that we're going to address some listener questions today. And boy, I'll tell you, this one is short and sweet from the question. I mean, straight to the point. Talk about cut to the bone, straight to the point. This one comes from one of our Drum Forum listeners, Patrick, that we've talked about before. He had a very, very succinct question, and we're going to try to address it the best we can. And he asks us, do you ever get nervous? And then what do you do to counteract that? And I'll give you my two little bits of info, and then we'll let John go forward with it. And my two small bits is this. One, be as prepared as you possibly can.
Amen.
I mean, and we're talking, you know, we've done a couple of podcasts, one on gig preparation, and that's the first part of being prepared, is be prepared for the gig. And that means learn the music, anything that a band leader can give you to say, hey, we have to do this stuff, learn it. Learn that stuff as best as you can. Make charts if you have to. And then we also did a thing on personal responsibility, and that is a little bit on preparation and also, but it has to do more with like personal things, like make sure you have your gear ready, make sure you're using the right tools for the right gig, make sure you're going to be on time, make sure you know your route, make sure your car, your transportation, however, make sure that it is trustworthy and ready to go. So preparation, 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 right? And then the second part of this is that nervousness, shall we say, is a type of anxiety. And that type of anxiety, or I should say any anxiety, really is regarding something in the future, something that hasn't happened. And as our listeners that have heard all these shows know, we like to wax psychological on here. We play ham-fisted shade tree psychiatrist on here. And the I guess the quick and dirty definition of two of the great mental maladies of our time is depression is a worry over something that has happened in the past, and anxiety is a worry over something that hasn't happened yet. So we're going to call nervousness an anxiety-style disorder, and it's worry over, again, things that haven't happened on the gig yet, right? Mm-hmm. So my cure-all, being the king of anxiety, and the only thing that I have ever found that works on this and that works consistently is you have to walk toward the anxiety and just take it on and do it. The more you avoid, the worse it gets, and the anxiety feeds upon itself, so to speak. Or the and in anxiety here, we're calling that nervousness, right? So these anxieties or nervousness you might have toward anything that you can't control in the future, you have to move toward it and attack it. Because if you don't move forward on it, again, it will feed upon itself and it will continue. It'll be the vicious cycle of getting worse and worse and worse if you avoid it. So that's my take on it, is prepare yourself for every possible thing that you can, right, that you have control over. And then the things that you don't have control over that make you nervous, you just have to move forward and attack it and do it. And then hopefully your nervousness will start to subside for future events. So there's my take.
Good stuff. Mine is a little, I think when I think about gigs that I get nervous about, it's typically one of two things. It can be where there's a certain band or certain players, or it's a gig that a certain drummer's doing that I'm filling in for, and you know, their legendary status, or they're, you know, everybody's raving about this and that, and I can get pretty worked up about that, you know, like if I had a dollar for every musician I know that is not unlike me, and that you have this never-ending I'm going to be found out crap that goes on in your brain, I am so out of control with that. Like, you know, what is the worst case scenario for me? I'm going to get called to do a session. It's going to be some burning Latin thing in odd time that you have to read down once. That's never going to happen. You know, so like, why am I creating this? I'm going to get found out. I never take any gigs that I don't belong on. So that in itself is just neurosis that is doing nothing but, you know, causing me pain. Mm-hmm. It's just not going to be, it's not realistic. And the other part, you know, being prepared, I prepare largely based on my insecurity. Like, man, I want to be as comfortable as I can, because, you know, look, like on my gig that I do, I'm pretty unintimidated. I'm like, yeah, there's better drummers. I hire the best drummers I can find, because I'm like, man, it's a big old fat groove gig. I got a pretty good handle on that. I'm not worried about it. But, you know, going into these, I did a gig the other night, you know, the band's legendary for this. We'll play whatever you request. Mm-hmm. And that's just not my skill set, man. And it just freaks me out. And I just, like, the whole day I'm like a nervous wreck, you know. I mean, a couple songs just kind of aren't great, but in general, the gig's fine. Everybody's happy. Nobody gets hurt. It's all good. You know a lot. You remember a lot more than you think you do. But I think that the nervousness comes more from ability for me than anything. Like, I don't, you know, my technique's not together, or I'm not real well versed in this and that. You know, I counter it with, I just don't take gigs that I shouldn't be on. So that's helped me lessen my nervousness. The other part of it, playing with musicians, you know, like you hold in high regard, whatever, man, they're going to have their opinion of you no matter what. go in and do what you do. Do the best job you can do. Be musical. Be professional. Be chill. Be aware of your surroundings. Do the best job you can do. And if someone's going to, if someone doesn't dig your playing, they don't dig your playing. There's not a whole lot you can do about it. It is what it is. So that's my battle and somewhat of a solution, I guess.
Sure. Well, you know, there's a pretty valid concept out there that basically says that the human mind, from over all the years and years and years of development and evolution, still has the bias toward hanging on to negative thoughts as a defense mechanism,
mm-hmm.
as opposed to emboldening and really hanging on to the positive stuff. And I think it all comes back to just being of surviving, you know. And of course, in today's society, we don't necessarily have to worry about being eaten by a T-Rex or a, you know, or a saber-toothed tiger. Our stuff now is worried about getting attacked on Twitter.
Yeah.
You know, and so, you know, and so it's the kind of thing that where these different mental maladies, so to speak, are brought on by an entirely separate and non-threatening set of circumstances, but yet our poor little brains interpret them as, oh my gosh,
just crippling.
Yeah, that this, you know, a grizzly bear is going to jump out. It treats it the same way. So unfortunately, like I said, there's real, aside from, you know, just trying to prepare, you know, the hard fact of the whole thing is you just have to move toward it. It's just like John said. I mean, you know, there are times that you're going to be dealing with some people that no matter how you play, they're going to have a preconceived notion or have a certain feeling about the way that you play that may not change. And that's okay. But you move forward, you do the gig, and you come out and everything's going to be fine.
Yep.
I will guarantee you, you'll feel better about yourself than if you cowered back and you know, and tried to shy away from it, so mm-hmm. to speak. Go forward. Move forward is my
opinion. And learn from scenarios. Like the other night I played a gig where, you know, all the standard dance crap I knew, but the first set I thought was a little rough. And I could have asked, you know, I could have been proactive and said, hey, man, what's going to happen? You know, are we doing any kind of low-key stuff? What do you do? Because everybody approaches that a little different. And, you know, instead of me just flipping out like I would have years ago, like, oh, everybody hated my playing because of two songs that weren't great. You know, I'm like, hey, you know what? Next time, I'm going to make sure I have a good handle on what is expected me outside of the obvious.
Perfect.
And that will eliminate some anxiety for me.
Yep.
Going into another gig similar to that.
We're going to finish up today with one of our favorite segments. We're going to each have a take on a great overlooked / underappreciated drummer. And so, John, why don't you go first? I know what your pick is before this. I'm going to go ahead and say, man, this is your show today. You picked a, man, super winner.
Yeah.
Go right ahead.
My guy today is the legendary L.A. session drummer. And I say legendary because when I say his name and you think about it, you're like, yeah, you're right. And that's Carlos Vega, who is just insanely great on every level and kind of was a victim of other insanely great players that were just smack dab in the middle of the Los Angeles recording scene when he was. You know, your Picaros and your John Robinsons and your Harvey Masons, and I mean, the list is endless. Mm-hmm. But Carlos was doing every bit as brilliant playing and grooving and stretching as anybody. A broad set of live gigs, did a lot of records, like, you know, that really were high level GRP was one that Dave Grusin stuff. He did a lot of that stuff. And, you know, quite frankly, he could have pretty much just done one record that I know you'll agree with me on and cemented the status in my mind in it. And that's the live James Taylor record from the mid to late 80s. I mean, just beyond amazing and musical and just undeniable.
There are so many good things on that record that you could just spend the whole time talking about that record. I mean, aside from great groove playing, there's some so many little subtle things he does that I was telling you before we recorded this that I've ripped off of his that I play on some of the every time I have to cover a James Taylor tune. Mm-hmm. I throw back to that live record and cop some of Carlos Vega's stuff that he does.
Yeah, I mean, yeah. I actually defer to that even instead of the original stuff because it's just so great. And he kind of ties together a modern approach. And like, you know, like Fire and Rain, you know, mm-hmm. that was Brushes, you know, like with mics cranked up and Russ Kunkel doing his thing. And it sounds fat and huge. Well, you're not going to... That's not going to translate live. So there's some, you know, he brought some of that into a and framed it in a live setting really well. Did some of his own thing, but, you know, still true to the spirit of the song and hippened up a few things.
Yeah.
Modernized a few things. There's some other, I mean, you can dig into his discography like the other people we've mentioned and find a lot of incredible stuff. One record I mentioned to Phil, Matt Rawlings, the Nashville session pianist, keyboard player, who's just an unbelievable musician in his own right. He did a trio record that was instrumental that Carlos was on that I think it's called Balconies. Mm-hmm. And a lot more stretching, a lot more of Latin kind of stuff and that Carlos had a great handle on.
Yeah.
And his sound too, man, his sound, like every other LA session legend that from that period, their sound so together.
That snare drum sound on that live James Taylor
incredible thing,
it's a live record, it sounds like $1 million.
Yep.
I mean, really, that sound great.
Interestingly enough, you know who engineered that record?
Nope.
Russ's son, Nathaniel.
Talking about Kunkel? Russ Kunkel?
Yeah, who is an incredible engineer. He recorded that whole live. It was a series of shows, I think, and they pulled from. His son, I believe.
Wow.
Was that? So
keeping it the family, huh?
Talented family, nonetheless. But Carlos Vega, man, oh.
Incredible call.
Some great stuff, man, like live charisma stuff and all that, too, that he plays on.
Incredible call.
Thank you, Carlos.
Yeah. My guy that I'm going to talk about today, who, for the people that know me personally, know that this is not a stretch. They know that this is one of my favorite musicians, favorite players. But he is sorely under-recognized, in my opinion, is the great Kenny Washington. Yeah, oh my God. Woo. Yeah, there's probably nobody that swings any harder than Kenny Washington. Kenny Washington is a New York-based jazz drummer, and he is a traditionalist in the name of traditionalist. And as they say, in the dictionary, beside the word traditionalist, there is a picture of Kenny Washington, otherwise known as the Jazz Maniac. He used to have a show on the radio. Up in, I think it was in New York or New Jersey where the station was. He did it, man, for like 15 or 16 years where he hosted a show that he just played great historic jazz records. And he's well known throughout the jazz community as probably being the foremost jazz historian. This guy, not to sound sacrilegious to all the jazz purists, he probably knows as much or more than even the guys that are still alive that took part in making that history. Mm. I mean, this guy is scary from the standpoint of just his knowledge of jazz history, and he has arguably the greatest collection of music, jazz music, I should say, on the face of the planet.
I love that.
Yeah, it's absolutely amazing. So now that we've kind of talked about him in generalities, talk about his drumming a little bit. He really, again, comes from the true tradition of hard swinging, hard bop, bebop jazz.
Unapologetic.
Unapologetic. His mentors were Papa Joe Jones, so that'll tell you something right there, and Mel Lewis. Mm-hmm. Those were two of his great mentors. Also Philly Joe Jones. But he has sort of taken the reins, and he is now sort of the Papa Joe Jones. He'll call you a knucklehead, man, in a minute. Yeah, he'll call you a knucklehead in a minute. But his body of work absolutely speaks for itself. This guy has been on probably, and I'm going to be conservative when I say 300 recordings or so. And some of the ones that I really like, I made a little list of like half a dozen that I think it's worth checking out. Some of them start as early as like the mid-80s and go all the way up until like 2000 or so. One of my favorite ones he played on, and I'll try to put some videos up on our YouTube channel for this, because I'm going to say that more than, if not all of them, at least four of these are probably out of print. There's an album from the mid-80s by Ralph Moore called Images. Absolute brilliant. He also did a piano trio album with Mulgrew Miller in the late 80s called From Day to Day. Brilliant. One of the foremost piano trio albums in history was one that Tommy Flanagan did called Jazz Poet. There is a cut on there called Mean Streets, and I think that's what Tommy Flanagan used to actually call Kenny. Well, he used to use his nickname was Mean Streets. He is a brush god on that track. It doesn't get any higher level than that. He also played with Bill Charlap, or still does play with Bill Charlap from time to time. There's a great record from the early 2000s, I believe it was when it was recorded. It's called Written in the Stars. There was a very little-known record from the late 80s called Self-Portrait in Swing by a jazz guitarist named Joshua Breakstone. There's a little arrangement of Some Enchanted Evening on there that Kenny Washington's out of his mind on. And then, last one I'll mention is, there was a record by Marcus Prinnip and Tim Hagens, two trumpet players that did a tribute album to Freddie Hubbard, some of his recordings called Hub Songs. Kenny Washington's absolutely brilliant on there.
Awesome.
And then just the last few things I'll say about Kenny is that he is probably I'll go ahead and throw it out there, the greatest living jazz piano trio drummer. And if you just look at the piano trios that he's been a part of, oh my gosh, he's played with Benny Green's trio, Mulgrew Miller's trio, Bill Charlap, Tommy Flanagan. And I believe he is pretty much the steady drummer for Ahmad Jamal now, since Idris Muhammad passed away.
Yep.
I mean, he is just a brilliant, sensitive, historically accurate piano trio drummer. And then John, not to extend this anymore, but I got to throw my little quick story about him in there, and his legendary 22-inch Istanbul K that was on all those recordings from like the 80s, late 70s and 80s, all the way up until probably just a few years ago. I actually was the curator of that cymbal for about 2 weeks or so. He let me have it for a few weeks, simply from the standpoint of back when that Bosphorus cymbal company was up and rolling here in the Atlanta area. He let me hang on to that cymbal for a little while until I could get it up to those guys, mm-hmm. and try to get them to copy it, which unsuccessfully it just didn't happen. But that cymbal is absolute magic. And just a little bit of history behind that cymbal that some of our listeners will find kind of interesting. That cymbal was given to him by Mel Lewis.
Mm.
Yeah, one of his mentors. And if anybody knows the history of the old Ks, those old K's used to come in pairs when they were shipped from Turkey.
I didn't know that.
Yeah, they came in pairs. And Mel Lewis had a pair. He gave one symbol to Kenny Washington, and the other one went to Jeff Hamilton.
Wow.
Yeah, so they had sister symbols, you know. And, yeah, I got to hang on to that symbol for a little while. And then that symbol, for our symbol junkie listeners, that symbol is the prototype for the new K Zildjian Bounce Ride.
Mm. How did they do with it?
Really good, man. Hmm. If you've heard any of them, yeah, they're pretty good. Now, let me say, that being said, that symbol by itself, when I had it, and that was like 15 years ago, it had an enormous crack around the bell,
mm-hmm.
to where, I mean, it was it hung weird from a stand, you know.
Right.
So they did the best they can to try to copy a broken symbol.
Right.
That's what it was. So anyway, that's my guess. Yeah, educated guess. But the bounce, result. I've played a couple of those bounce rides, and they sound pretty good to my ears. I'll tell you that. So that's my call. Guys, listen to Kenny Washington. Just an absolute monster, beast, jazz drummer. His unapologetic bebop drummer. Just, he, every time he sits down, he brings about 10 legends to the bandstand with him.
I know I will. That's exciting, man. Thanks for sharing.
We gave these guys more for their money today, man. This is a long one.
Oh, I hope everybody is okay with that.
Yeah.
Free rambling.
Free rambling. That's right. Well, that's all I got, man. I can't talk anymore. My mouth's parched.
I'm hurting too.
Yeah.
That is a rare occurrence.
All right, guys. Stay in touch with us. Please give us send us emails at our Gmail account. Stay in touch with us on our Facebook and our Twitter account. And please go download us, stream us, rate us on iTunes. We love it.
We can take it.
Until next time, we'll see you later.
Bye.